In this episode of Skeptico, well-known parapsychologist Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove explains how radical skeptics are ignoring advances in consciousness research.
The same kind of blind unconsciousness that led the United States to launch an unprovoked war in the Middle East is the same level of consciousness with which certain people in the scientific community, particularly those who identify themselves as debunkers, radical skeptics. They're not true skeptics at all, but that's the same kind of blindness with which they buy into this paradigm of consciousness.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico. We're joined today by Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, noted parapsychology researcher and author. You may be familiar with The PK Man, A True Story of Mind Over Matter that came out a few years ago, or his book, The Roots of Consciousness, that was published many years ago, but is still very popular and in print. You may also know him as the host of the series that used to run on PBS called Thinking Aloud, a really excellent, excellent show that I've seen some episodes on the net, and it's really a wonderful show with some tremendous guests. He's currently the president of the Intuition Network, and we'll find out a little bit more about that in a minute as the show goes on. But first, Dr. Mishlove, thanks for joining us on Skeptico.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, in coming across a couple of the introductions that I've heard of you, I always seem to bring up the PhD in parapsychology from Berkeley, the only one issued. And I just couldn't resist digging into that a little bit further. I mean, you must have been one determined person to turn an institution and kind of turn them in the direction that you want them to go so that you could study the field that you wanted to study in. Can you tell us how that all evolved?
Well, I was very determined. I was a graduate student at Berkeley for 10 years. I received a master's degree in criminology, and then I went on to create an individual interdisciplinary doctoral major in parapsychology, selecting a committee of faculty members from different departments to support a degree in parapsychology. And to my knowledge, it's the only doctoral diploma in parapsychology ever awarded by an accredited American university. I can say that the closer I got to actually getting the degree, the more obstacles were put in front of me. But at the end of the day, yeah, I prevailed, and my doctoral dissertation has been published as a book called Psi Development Systems. It's been reviewed in the professional literature, and I would say if you read those reviews, you'll see it's been well received, even amongst mainstream psychologists.
Very good. And what made you decide that you wanted to go into parapsychology, maybe even going back a little bit further to your upbringing or your earlier education? What drove you or sparked you in that direction?
Well, let me say this. By the time I was a sophomore, junior in college as an undergraduate, I was basically a typical materialistic, skeptical person. I had grown up with a conventional Midwestern background. I was raised in a Jewish family in a small town, but I had pretty much rejected all of that. And then, beginning probably in my senior year in college, I began an intellectual quest to explore the literature of parapsychology and spiritualism. Eventually, this led to a series of precognitive dreams. And at that point, I began to feel that the phenomenon involved were so immediate to me and so important that it was worth my time and trouble to become an expert in the field, especially because when I began to consult with my other professors at the time and ask them for their opinions about the experiences I had had, none of them had anything intelligent to say whatsoever.
And I've heard you talk one time before on an interview about your story of your dream with your Uncle Harry. I thought that was a great story. Would you mind retelling that?
No, I don't mind. It was a very powerful experience. It occurred over 30 years ago, but I can remember it vividly because my great uncle Harry Schwamm appeared to me in a dream. I hadn't had any contact with him for many, many years, but the dream was very powerful, and I awoke from it, and I was crying and singing at the same time. It was as if I had really been touched in a very, very deep way by this person. And so I wrote home and said, well, how's Uncle Harry? I had a dream about him. And once my letter arrived, I received a phone call from my mother saying, how did you know Uncle Harry had just died? That really impressed me. It's the only time in my whole life I'd ever awakened from a dream singing and crying at the same time. That's a very, very poignant emotional state.
You know, one of the things I find fascinating about that story is how common it is with the experience of so many people. You know, when we talk about parapsychology and the somewhat controversial nature of it, it always strikes me how the just huge amount of natural history that we have. I mean, virtually any family that you talk to will have stories of this kind. Or I recently read the book by Diane Archangel, who was a hospice worker in Houston, has collected tens of thousands of stories of people who have had, it just came into hospice and wind up recounting stories of afterlife encounters. I mean, this is such a widespread common phenomena across cultures, across time, and yet, you know, as you, a public intellectual academic figure, you know, I'm sure that story has met with a lot of, at the time, met with a lot of skeptical looks and probably still does.
No, that's not true. I have, when I tell my story with the conviction that I have, that it happened to me and I remember it vividly years and years later, I have never encountered any skepticism about that story. It's a personal story. Many people may simply feel it doesn't pertain to them or it's not going to prove anything to anybody but me, perhaps. But the typical response when I share that story is other people come up to me with their own stories.
Sure.
And usually they preface them by saying, you know, I've never told this to anybody else before, but I want you to know about it.
Ah, but isn't that really the point? I've never told this to anyone before. I mean, aren't we stuck kind of in the middle? I mean, on one side we have the religious fundamentalism that still pervades the culture on one side, and on the other side we have an intellectual scientific community that just scoffs or just makes fun of anyone who has these kind of stories. So,
and you know, as far as I'm concerned, those two camps are the mirror image of each other. They're both typically very dogmatic. They've both formed their opinions on the basis of something other than an authentic scientific inquiry. I think they're both foolish, to be honest.
Well, that's interesting. What do you think is the best evidence? Yourself, who's been a parapsychology researcher, what do you think is the best scientific evidence we have for consciousness?
For consciousness?
Parapsychology, we can go in so many different directions, precognition, telepathy.
Okay, because what you're talking about is the role of consciousness in the physical world is something other than, let us say, an epiphenomenon produced by neural signals in the brain.
And that's exactly the point, right? Because, I mean, the current existing paradigm inside of standard academia is that we have the brain and nothing else. We have this 3 pounds of meat up there, and whatever we're experiencing, whatever we're living, is totally a result of a chemical, biological process.
Well, I'm glad you called it a paradigm, because if you know, that is a word that was introduced in its most precise form in the classic book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. And one of the definitions of a paradigm is that it's so deep, it's so intrinsic to our thinking that it's really unconscious. And People assume just what you've said, that basically it's a materialistic paradigm, and therefore consciousness is something of a byproduct of the brain's physiology. But if you talk to philosophers of science, people who rigorously examine the problem of consciousness, I would say there's pretty much consensus that that point of view is something that is assumed. It is not something that has been established in the normal scientific way.
Have we been able to establish an alternative paradigm to an extent that it's valid within the scientific methods that we have?
I think if you look at the literature, you will see that there are many very educated and articulate voices arguing for an alternative paradigm. And I'll give you one example. Sir John Eccles, the Nobel laureate in neurophysiology, who has argued for a different view of consciousness as something that exists independently of the brain. The idea has also been very well articulated in books by Professor Amit Goswami, formerly in the Department of Physics at the University of Oregon in Eugene, and a person who has written many books on quantum physics. It's a paradigm that you find explored in very rigorous philosophical language in the cosmologies and philosophies of Asia, Vedanta and Buddhism. And it's consistent with modern science. And, of course, the evidence of parapsychology certainly points toward that paradigm rather than the epiphenomenalism paradigm, which is basically assumed in an unthinking way by many, many people today. Let me put it this way. I think the same kind of blind unconsciousness that led the United States to launch an unprovoked war in the Middle East is the same level of consciousness with which certain people in the scientific community, particularly those who identify themselves as debunkers, radical skeptics. They're not true skeptics at all, but that's the same kind of blindness with which they buy into this paradigm of consciousness, and that's not true skepticism at all. That's taking the attitude of a true believer.
Well, one of the aspects of that I find particularly interesting is when you really delve into that position, that counterposition, that the reductionist, materialist kind of point of view, it leads to some conclusions that I think are just well outside of the mainstream of what any person would kind of accept. I mean, I wonder if you could speak for a minute on free will, which I think is really part of that paradigm, which says there is no free will, and they, I think when they say that, they mean that in the way that you would kind of just think about it in terms of your thoughts and your decisions are really not your own.
Well, 19th century materialists and even 18th and 17th century philosophers believed that there was no free will. For example, the very elegant and very spiritual philosophy of Baruch Spinoza was based on the idea that there is no free will whatsoever. Although I say it was spiritual because he believed the only free will was the will of God. In any case, today we have a loophole in quantum physics. We have the uncertainty principle, which means that we cannot predict things with absolute certainty. And that kind of leaves an opportunity for free will to fit into the picture, even using the most well-established ideas of modern science today.
Perhaps, I spoke a couple weeks ago to Dr. Sue Blackmore in the UK, and
yes,
she recently completed a book and spoke to many of the leading researchers in consciousness, including Daniel Dennett and many other names that mm-hmm. kind of make their way into the public sphere more often than some of the other voices. And categorically,
well, just because somebody is popular doesn't mean that they're profound.
But the point I was going to make is, categorically, down the line, all of them said that they did not believe in free will and they didn't think free will was existed. Interestingly enough, though, and she said she was surprised by this, although I don't know why anyone would be.
Yeah.
They all said that they led their life as if they did have free will.
Not only that, our legal system is based on the idea of free will. If there were no such thing as free will, then we might as well throw out our whole legal system, which is based on the idea that if you commit a crime, it has to be done with the intent to commit a crime. In the absence of that intention, everybody should get an exemption from crime and from punishment. I mean, why punish anyone for committing a crime if they had no choice to begin with? So as you say, that belief, to the extent that these people like Sue Blackmore and Daniel Dennett actually hold that belief, it is totally against a lot of mainstream thinking.
Right. Let me shift gears for a minute and talk about
it. But the point that they're making is there's no room for free will in the conventional scientific paradigm.
Exactly.
But nor is there any room for consciousness at all. If you're Daniel Dennett or Sue Blackmore, it's very hard to explain why anybody is consciousness or if anyone is consciousness, is conscious, if anyone is conscious. There's no explanation for normal consciousness within that paradigm. What they try to do is explain it away with linguistic tricks.
Well said. You know, to follow up on that, let me go ahead and play a brief clip from that interview and get your response, if I could.
Okay.
We live in a pointless universe. We're here for no reason at all. There isn't a soul. There isn't a spirit. We're not going to live forever in some kind of heaven or something like that. And I think there are no paranormal phenomena, although I can't be sure about that, but I really think there aren't. Yet, we have extraordinary experiences.
Let's stop it right there. Any comments on that?
Well, I think Sue Blackmore is a lovely person. I met her back in 1976 when she considered herself a parapsychologist, and she actually started out as a tarot reader. And I respect that she's entitled to her opinion. And I think a skeptic, if you really want to be a skeptic, you can easily convince yourself that all the purported psychic experiences, even the ones that occur in rigorous laboratory conditions, can be explained away as something like fluke phenomenon or, you know, rare phenomenon that will occur by chance alone.
You know, the other part that I was hoping you could comment on about that quote from Sue Blackmore is just, well, there's a couple aspects of it. One is, have we really determined all that? Have we really determined that it's a pointless universe? Is that a decided fact? And I guess the other point is just how from a psychological standpoint, what a horrible psychological burden that if it's a choice to choose a worldview or a philosophy, gosh, who would want to choose that one?
Well, let me respond to both things. First of all, it is not, and it cannot be, an established fact that the universe is pointless, because basically, I think what Sue Blackmore is saying is that meaning only exists within our puny little human minds, and that the universe itself is devoid of meaning. Well, that's a materialistic perspective. It also happens to be the perspective of some very spiritual people, like Buddhists, who would say almost the same thing and yet say it from a perspective of deep spirituality. So it doesn't bother me particularly that she holds that point of view. All I can say is that it's unknowable. People who believe in a deity, who have a religious point of view, would say that the closer you get to the deity, the more meaningful everything is, that the deity is the essence of meaning and gives meaning to everything. Now, Buddhists are odd in this regard, because they think that the deities themselves are relative and have no absolute existence. Even the Buddha has no absolute existence. At the end of the day, all is pure nirvana or nothingness, and yet it is a very, very elegant and meaningful philosophy, ironically.
Right, and I think it's also a philosophy and a and a religion that does point to a collective consciousness and a collective meaning that we all share. I mean,
you can find that in Buddhism, but ultimately they say even this must be transcended.
Yeah, perhaps maybe you're a better Buddhist scholar than I am. I just think, isn't there that division in Buddha, the one that sees Buddha's ascension to nirvana as the ultimate goal, and the other sees that when Buddha reaches there, he comes back to get the rest of consciousness and the rest of all of us together and of that understanding?
Well, it's a rich and complex tradition, but I'm just suggesting that, you know, you can explore the paranormal and be an atheist or a materialist. There are many parapsychologists who are, and how you ultimately ascribe meaning to the universe, it's a deep philosophical question. I don't think it's one that science is capable of answering.
Good point. And then how about the second point of the psychological implications of choosing a worldview, and maybe the implications of what that atheistic academic worldview, what that might have?
Well, let me say this. I think that Sue Blackmore made a very interesting strategic decision after she got her doctoral degree about 30 years ago and got a university position to align herself with the skeptics. That was a move that probably helped her much more in her academic career than had she maintained an alignment with the parapsychologists, who have always had to struggle and basically who have always been under attack by people such as herself. So maybe she's right. She really had no free will in doing that. It was just a question of sociological pressures.
Why do you think the parapsychology community has struggled so? And maybe as a fine-tuning that a little bit, why has the parapsychology community sometimes seemed to have shot itself in the foot in the past in terms of the kind of experiments that were designed and carried out? And in particular, I guess I think there seem to be so many experiments that look for psi phenomena or ESP phenomena as being just some kind of random thing that we can just pull people in off the streets and test them and see their psychic abilities.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean exactly when you say parapsychology has shot itself in the foot. My reading of the history of parapsychology, and it goes back to the era of William James and his predecessors back into the 1880s, now 130 years ago or so, I think you have an enormous body of very talented, gifted, and dedicated scientists doing good work, which has continually been improved and refined over the decades. The fact that it has met with a lot of resistance is due to the fact that it tends to challenge the unconscious paradigm of mainstream materialism, and it's a very elusive phenomenon. We're dealing with a weak phenomenon. It's not necessarily highly replicable, things of that sort. And certain people, as we pointed out earlier, both the dogmatic skeptics who believe that this is the rising tide of irrationalism and the dogmatic religious fundamentalists who believe it is the rising tide of the devil, are opposed to this kind of research.
But don't you think we'd have better results if we pursued the best shamans and mystics and psychics as our research subjects rather than random college students or even younger? You know, we have the whole body of the Ganzfeld experiments.
I think there's room for both. There are plenty of researchers who focus on just working with the extremely talented subjects. Others focus on random populations. It's useful to do both. And I think you have to also be aware of the fact that just because somebody professes to be a shaman or a psychic doesn't mean that they necessarily are really gifted at doing the sorts of things that will work well in a laboratory.
You know, that might be a good lead into some of the work that you've done over many years in remote viewing work, and I think that's probably led to some of your work now with the Intuition Network. Would you care to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I'm president of a nonprofit organization called the Intuition Network. The purpose of this network is to help people, encourage people to cultivate their own inner intuitive abilities, by which we mean listening. It means people who are not necessarily going to be guided by the external authorities, whether scientific authorities or religious authorities, who are happy to tell you that they know how you should live your life, but rather people who are going to be guided from within. Naturally, parapsychology plays a role in intuition, but in a sense, intuition is a larger phenomenon than just ESP and precognition and telepathy.
What was the need that you saw that you were trying to fill with the Intuition Network, and how do you plan to do that?
Well, we live in a culture which is dominated by the mental faculties of a non-intuitive nature. For example, if you look at the world about you, you'll see sensationalism is very big. People are going for thrills. Emotionalism is very big. You'll turn on the TV all the time on the news, and they're trying to get people to cry in public and you know, reveal their emotions in public, and people get caught up and worked up emotionally about politics and other issues. And then you have the intellectualism, which is very, very big. People who feel that they can solve all of the world's problems by thinking them through intellectually, starting with premises that they often don't think through, unfortunately. But intuition, listening to that, what has often been called the still, soft voice within, gets less encouragement and support, socially speaking. I mean, I think an example of that is the fact that I'm, you know, the only person to receive a doctoral diploma in parapsychology. It's just one tiny symptom of the fact that our culture does not support the cultivation of intuition. Now, Carl Jung, as you may know, the great Swiss psychiatrist, felt that intuition was one of the four mental functions, along with feeling, intellect, and sensation. Our culture seems to be out of balance in that regard, and as a result, the kinds of people who have cultivated intuition in their lives are disenfranchised in our culture, by which I mean, for example, indigenous people or women, who the culture of women tends to be somewhat more intuitive, I think, in some regards anyway, than men, or third world peoples. There, we need to restore a balance. People who feel a kinship with the earth, for example.
So in your work with the Intuition Network, then, are you looking more at kind of practical applications for some of this? And
yeah, we're very interested in practical applications. We have in our organization individuals who work, for example, with the police. Intuitives who work with the police, intuitives who work in the area of financial forecasting. Those are two examples of practical applications. Intuitives who work in medical diagnosis. But mostly what we're trying to do is serve as a mutual support network for people who are out on a limb doing this kind of work, often without a support system, people who will give them permission to explore in this area, not just permission, but encouragement. So one of the main things we do is just help small groups of people get together in a very quiet way to provide emotional support for this sort of thing. We're not seeking publicity necessarily. We're not trying to change the world overnight. We're trying to build a long-term social movement.
Okay, a long-term social movement around the idea of
redressing the cultural imbalance.
that leads to another question. Back to the paradigm issue and how we're stuck with an existing paradigm that was a reaction to a theological paradigm that we kind of overthrew. What do you see as being the kind of things that are going to allow us to shift this latest paradigm? And do you see any evidence that that's happening?
Well, I think we have to be very patient. Paradigms, as profound as this, shift very, very slowly. You know, give you an example of what I mean. I think it was about 230 years ago or so, they were burning witches in the state of Massachusetts. And if we go back a few more hundred years, many people across Europe, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions, were tortured as being suspected of witchcraft. That was the paradigm. Today, the general paradigm is that witchcraft doesn't exist at all. But it takes hundreds of years, and there are a lot of fears associated with these sorts of things. There are deep fears that people have of the possibility of psychic phenomena. Sigmund Freud pointed out that we don't even want to know what's in our own mind. That's why we create the Freudian unconscious, where things about ourselves that we don't want to know are forced into through a process Freud called repression. So if we, modern civilized people, aren't willing to look inside of our own psyches, how can we possibly tolerate the idea that other people might have this ability? That's what we're up against here. And I think we have to be very, very patient in expecting the culture to change around these issues.
I can't let the Freud comment go, since you've talked to so many intelligent intellectual figures. What about the whole fact that Freud has just been completely discredited in the last 20 years as a charlatan, really nothing more? I mean, what do you make of all that?
Well, I grew up and went to college at the University of Wisconsin in psychology, which was a behavioral school, and the behaviorists had this attitude about the Freudians, but I don't think they really discredited Freud. It was just their attitude. The truth is, if surveys of people in the psychiatric profession, even today, will tell you that Freud was amongst the greatest influences in their career. Now, there are certain aspects of Freudian theory that have been overturned. You know, one of my professors, Michael Scriven, was a philosopher of science, and he made a very interesting comparison between parapsychology and Freudianism. He said, parapsychology is a science where we have a lot of data in search of a theory, and Freudian psychology is a discipline in which there's a lot of theory in search of data.
Yeah, and the fact that what's come out in the last 20 years is his papers that were by him kept secret for so long is that he manufactured the data, and that he published papers that were totally fabricated about clients that he never had and situations that just completely didn't exist.
I'm not aware of that, but let me say this.
No, it's off topic, but I mean, if you...
Well, it's not necessarily off topic. It's, you know, one needs to examine these things, but I simply say, if you look at the 20th century as a whole, a 100-year period, I don't think there could be any doubt that Freud was one of the great intellects who shaped that century.
Yeah, but you could look at it two ways. It's because he completely promoted these ideas and these philosophies, these theories, as you say, that were really total fabrications that have been kind of dismantled since then.
Well, I think they had such an important influence in the 20th century and even today because people resonated with them. And the idea of the Freudian unconscious, which is the idea to which I referred, I think is a very valid idea, whatever else you may say about Freud.
I think he was able to kind of combine a lot of ideas of the moment and certainly communicate them in a way that had a huge, huge impact. But I'll stay with Jung, and you can have Freud. But anyways,
I don't want to make too much of Freud. I'm much fonder of Jung, who one of his disciples who had serious disagreements with Freud.
Oh, I know what else I want to talk about. Can you tell me about any current research that you might be doing and what that's, how that's affecting your views on some of these things?
Well, I am. You mentioned remote viewing earlier, and I am involved in some remote viewing projects. It's a fascinating field. There's a lot of good published data in the area of remote viewing. It's an area that has been applied successfully in financial forecasting. There are several good published studies in that area, and that's an area I continue to explore. I'm very interested in the whole question of financial forecasting.
Now, is that an area that could lead to the paradigm shift? And that's, the, to me, the straight, most straightforward way to do it is just set up a hedge fund with a bunch of remote viewers and just blow the doors off of everyone else, and then it's case closed. I mean, there really wouldn't be a lot of discussion after that. Why not do that?
Well, and there are people who are working on that. It's not necessarily as easy a problem as it might seem. You know, I work in the area of financial forecasting with other technologies as well, a lot of computer analysis, neural networks. They all have their difficulties, and they all have their successes. And the problem is, even when a method is quite successful, and I've seen some real successes, by chance alone, you will get successes of that sort. Now, whether we'll get to the point where these things are consistently successful over a long period of time, we'll have to wait and see. As I say, some developments can take a long time, and psychic phenomenon, remote viewing, like other forms of extrasensory perception, are very sensitive to such things as the emotional states, the attitudes of the people involved in doing this work. So I have to say at this point, and I've spent decades looking at the practical applications of remote viewing, we still have a long way to go. I think we need to be patient in terms of seeing. I'd love to be able to say, yes, you know, I've made hundreds of millions of dollars already doing remote viewing in the markets, but we're a very, very long way from that.
Great. What areas do you think will be most fruitful for the application of RV in the next?
Well, I'm very impressed by the archaeological studies done by Stephen Schwartz. I think for many reasons, those studies have been particularly successful. I think one important aspect of it is that the targets are of what Stephen would call numinous value, meaning that there's, when you're looking at ancient ruins, temples perhaps, there's something about those targets that are especially attractive to remote viewers, perhaps more so than targets relating to the financial markets, because people have a lot of mixed feelings about using a psychic ability for personal gain. I think the data has been much more consistently positive in the archaeological work.
As we move towards closing this thing up, are there any other areas we might talk about or anything else you're currently interested in discussing?
Well, I know that you call your website Skeptico, and I think you're doing an admirable job trying to balance a skeptical perspective with a perspective that's willing to really engage with the data. To me, that's true skepticism, and I've been very discouraged by a lot of people, the PsyCop crowd in particular, who label themselves as skeptics, but they're not real skeptics at all. They're very dogmatic debunkers, and I hope that people who are true skeptics, such as I presume you to be, will take a stance against that kind of phony skepticism.
Thank you very, very much for joining us today on Skeptico, Dr. Mishlov.
Well, thank you for the interview. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Mishlov again for joining us today on Skeptico. Again, if you'd like to learn more about his books or his recent project, The Intuition Network, you can find links in the show notes at skeptico.com. That's skeptiko.com. While you're there, you can also drop us a note via email or leave us a voicemail message. Well, that's going to do it for today. We have a lot of exciting interviews coming up and some really exciting news on the experimental front, where we're going to try and help fund some replications of some pretty interesting experiments, and we're going to be seeking your help and your involvement in doing that. I think it's going to be a very, very exciting project. Stay tuned in the next couple weeks for more. Bye for now.